CBSI on the World. I'm John Batchelor with my colleague Gregory Copley, editor and publisher of Defense and Foreign Affairs. Nigeria, the most important election in Africa in this calendar year, perhaps on the planet, is in Nigeria. The rich, resourced, large population, growing aggressively state. I read a headline from Germany, Deutsche Welle, in these last hours. Nigeria's 2023 election. Former President Obasanjo backs Peter Obi. Nigerians will vote for president on February 25th, writes the Deutsche Welle. Around 95 million votes are expected to participate in the crucial election as many grow increasingly disenchanted with the quality of Nigerian politics. Peter Obi of the Labour Party has received a major endorsement from former President Obasanjo. Gregory, are you surprised by this? We've talked of Peter Obi before. He's a favorite of the urban elite who live their lives on the internet and have access to means, resources, and travel. Is Peter Obi a choice of the interior of the country? Good evening to you.
Good evening, John. Well, Peter Obi is a stimulating and provocative politician, but he does not have the interior or the north of Nigeria, and he doesn't even have all of the south and southeast. So basically, he's not going anywhere. And no, the endorsement by former President Obasanjo, Olusegun Obasanjo, does not surprise me one bit, bearing in mind that Obasanjo was a military president of the country and was the first elected civilian president after the military dictatorship of Sani Abacha collapsed with Abacha's death. I met with Obasanjo on many occasions. I met with him in Washington, D.C., once when he was just released from Abacha's prison and he was recovering. And I actually spent on and off in over a couple of weeks a series of conversations to encourage him to go back into the civilian political arena and reclaim, if you like, the legitimate democratic base of the country. And he did so. But I noticed that Obasanjo more or less didn't want to acknowledge anybody else. And if you did put yourself in a position where he thought he may owe you, he would ignore you thereafter. And I saw him do that to some of his colleagues in Nigeria, and particularly to his own vice president, Atiku Abubakar, who is now the front runner in Obasanjo's own party, the PDP, for the presidency in the February elections this year. And I saw the rapprochement engineered in Abuja between Obasanjo and Atiku. And I never believed that Obasanjo was ever going to want to honor that. Now, he couldn't very well, being the former standard bearer for the PDP, he couldn't go out and endorse the real opponent of Atiku in this election, who's the former Lagos governor, Tinubu, because that would have been seen as absolutely betraying his the party which made Obasanjo viable. So he did the next thing, which was to endorse Obi. And that is like a vote for nobody, because everybody knows that no matter what Obasanjo's endorsement is going to do, it's not going to get Obi across the finishing line with enough votes in enough states to get him the presidency. But it was still typical of Obasanjo that he would want to do a, you know, feel like a put down of his former vice president, as he does a put down to many other people to whom he has owed his career.
The Obi supporters are making a case about age, Gregory. I mentioned that Tinubu is 70 years old, former governor of Lagos State. You've spoken well of him as a governor of Lagos State. That's the All Progressive Congress. And Atiku is 75, former vice president, as you've said. Is age a factor here?
Age is definitely a factor. And the interesting thing is that Tinubu is seen as being the old man, and he certainly acts and speaks like the old man, whereas Atiku at 75 only a few months younger than me, he's actually extremely vibrant and energetic. He has been out on the campaign trail day and night, crisscrossing the country, speaking, meeting, talking to people. He listens to people, which is critical. And what you see is Obasanjo never once doing a debate, never once doing a real interview. When he gave a talk at Chatham House in the Royal Institute of International Affairs in London, he wouldn't even take questions. He delegated the questions to his team, which tells you that literally Tinubu doesn't have the sophistication on the international scene. He was a wheeler dealer at the Lagos state government level when he was building up the city of Lagos, and frankly, that's been a remarkable success. But that doesn't translate into being a national leader comprehending the vast complexity of the country. And he's also the standard bearer for the current APC government of General Buhari, which has impoverished the nation dramatically. You've got to the stage now where 80% of the population now lives in poverty. And we're soon going to see, within our lifetimes, hopefully, we're going to see the population of Nigeria rise to be to the third largest population in the world of any country. So something has to be done, and it cannot be business as usual. Now, Peter Obi wouldn't be as much business as usual, but he's honest and energetic, but he's come up with nothing which has been creative. Atiku has. He's broken the mold, even of all the old PDP presidents. He's broken the mold and is coming up with innovative new approaches to social management, to economics, to stimulating investment and creativity. He is the first true ideologically committed conservative we've seen coming in Nigeria. There have been intrinsic conservatives, if you like, in the past. But he has thought it through from an economics point of view. Smaller government, more stimulation of the economy in terms of opening up protection for private investors, whether they're domestic or foreign investors, and so on. So he's really outlined real policy options. None of the other candidates, including Peter Obi, have done that.
Ethiopia. This November 2nd ceasefire, always watching, because it was a ferociously dark conflict, that civil war, between Addis Ababa, the Prime Minister Abiy, and the Tigray Popular Liberation Front. We have this in these last days, over the holidays. Mediators between Ethiopia's federal government and authorities in the Tigray region, embroiled until last month in a brutal war, are stepping up efforts to enforce a truce as relations between the two sides inch closer toward normality. Is this going in a good direction, Gregory? And are the Oromo dissenters a complication here?
Firstly, the Oromo dissenters are a big problem, but they were never as big a problem as the Tigray Popular Liberation Front, largely because the TPLF had starting out with a 30,000-man standing army trained and armed by the United States when the TPLF was ruling Ethiopia. One of the deals that the Obama administration did with the then government of Millet Zenawi was in exchange for the U.S. getting use of air bases in southern Ethiopia, he actually trained, armed, and financed the TPLF's private army. It's the SS, if you like, of the TPLF. It was a party army, and they were very, very good and efficient in many respects, and certainly well-equipped, trained by U.S. Special Forces. So they have now been comprehensively defeated by the Federal Armed Forces of Prime Minister Abiy, who assumed office in 2018. And so essentially now, we're moving towards, and I'll feel much more comfortable, when the TPLF has been completely disarmed. It delayed its disarmament after the November peace accord, or the November surrender, if you like, of the TPLF, on the basis that they wouldn't disarm while there were still Eritrean forces in the country. And now those Eritrean forces, I believe, have been formally removed from Ethiopia and from Tigray province itself. And therefore, there is no impediment for the TPLF disarming. They ran out of ammunition. They ran out of money. the United States stopped or was ceased to be able to continue supporting them with arms and money. So the TPLF had nowhere to go. They had to surrender. I believe that some of the senior ideologues who are profoundly radical Marxists would try to start the war again if they could, and they will have to be watched extremely carefully. Now the Abiy government is going to have to move decisively to split the Tigrayan people away from this Marxist military group, the TPLF, and make sure that the Tigrayans once again have a vibrant role within the Ethiopian economy. And I think they're going to do that because, let's face it, Tigray also has a lot of the tourist attractions of Ethiopia, the wonderful stelae, the ancient monuments at Aksum. And Aksum is where the St. Mary's Church is, where the Ark of the Covenant is, and so on. There's a huge, a lot of tourist capability there in Tigray, which could be mined, if you like, for the benefit of the people. So now Abiy has to concentrate on reforming the constitution, which he promised to do, including the privatization of property. And he needs also to finish that war with his own ethnic group, the Oromo Liberation Front. One of the things he's doing, he's improving the agricultural sector dramatically to the point where, despite the La Nina climate effect, Ethiopia will be a net exporter of wheat this year, which is really significant.
Gregory, who gains from the disorder in Ethiopia? Is there an outside hand, or is this decades of abuse after the communist takeover?
Well, and this has been going on for a couple of hundred years. The Egyptians have always claimed that Ethiopia was withholding Egypt's water from it. The reality of international water law is that upstream riparian states have the right to exploit the waters of any river passing through. However, the Egyptians and the Sudanese were given a treaty by Britain, which occupied Egypt and Sudan in the 19th and early 20th century, which basically said that they could divide up the Nile waters, the Blue Nile waters, coming out of Ethiopia. Well, the reality is that Britain drew up this treaty, which it had no right to draw up. It certainly didn't involve Ethiopia, and Ethiopia was not a signatory to it. But the Egyptians used this to claim that Ethiopia should give them more water. Well, the reality is that Ethiopia is getting a lot of it's passing all the waters of the Nile downstream to Sudan and Egypt. And what you have is the Aswan Dam, built by Egypt and the Soviet Union in about 1960, which is holding back a lot of the Nile waters, which regulates the flow of the Nile down into the Nile Delta. But it also stops the flow of that rich Amhara Highland fertile soil, which was topsoil, which was going down and nourishing the Nile Delta in the past. And now it's just banking up behind the old Aswan Dam, which extends Lake Nasser into Sudan. The reality is that Egypt has quadrupled its population in the past few decades, but it hasn't quadrupled its water supply. It's on the contrary, it's misused its water supply. It's been very, very inefficient in its agricultural and irrigation uses of water, and needs to reform that. But in the short term, President Sisi of Egypt needs someone to blame, so he blames the Ethiopians, and therefore he has been forced back into the old Egyptian habit of sponsoring and arming Ethiopian separatist groups, including the Oromo Liberation Front. So that's where it's going now. I believe that, and we've been talking behind the scenes, we believe that there is a grand bargain to be had between Ethiopia and Egypt, between Prime Minister Abiy and President Sisi, which could start to address this enormous water and economic problem of the Horn of Africa and North Africa. And if that could be done, and I do believe it can be done, then we will start to see incredible prosperity in that region.
Gregory Copley, editor and publisher of Defense and Foreign Affairs, updating the critical election in Nigeria and the detente so far in Ethiopia, ripped by a civil war, that to my learning from Gregory, the U.S. was on the losing, wrong, violent side. Puzzling. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Patrick.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.